The Debate.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. U.S. President Donald Trump has granted clemency to two people who pleaded guilty in the Russia inquiry, four Blackwater guards convicted of killing Iraqi civilians, and three corrupt former Republican members of Congress. The four Blackwater security guards were convicted of murder and manslaughter in Iraq 6 years ago. Their pardon has drawn international condemnation, especially from the Iraqi people who lost some of their fellow countrymen in a Blackwater shooting. The Iraqi Foreign Ministry has also urged Washington to review that decision. What's behind Mr. Trump's disregard of the Iraqi people's sentiments, and why should he do such things on the last legs of his presidential tenure? Now let's go to Washington, D.C. to our own correspondent, Wyatt Reed, there and see what he has for us. Wyatt, over to you.
Well, it's an interesting question, just what is motivating Donald Trump to pardon these murderers, convicted murderers, men who, again, killed women, children, at least 14, children as young as 9 years old. So what may be motivating this, some observers have noted, is the relationship between the founder of Blackwater, Eric Prince, the brother of Betsy DeVos, Donald Trump's education secretary. So there is sort of an element of corruption, of nepotism. This kind of dynamic is certainly one to keep an eye out for. And as you pointed out, this decision to pardon these murderers has been condemned by international groups, including the UN Office of High Commission on Human Rights. The Iraqi Foreign Ministry did put out a statement noting that this decision was, quote, inconsistent with the U.S. administration's declared commitment to the values of human rights, justice, and the rule of law. I think that's an interesting word, the U.S. administration's declared commitment. They didn't say the U.S. administration's commitment, because judging by this decision and by so many more, it is really only a superficial commitment, and I think that may be something that is being underlined by this statement.
Okay, thank you for that. From Washington, D.C., that was Wyatt Reed. Now, joining me in this debate tonight will be author of the No More War, Daniel Kovalik, out of Pittsburgh, and also diplomat and political analyst Hatem Yavuz, who's joining us out of Turkey City of Istanbul. Welcome to the show, both. Let's go to Daniel. 17 Iraqi civilians, including two children, were killed when Blackwater forces opened fire in Baghdad's Nisour Square in 2007. On what ground has Mr. Trump pardoned them?
Well, I don't think he has stated a ground, and I don't think he has to. You know, as the president, he has virtually unreviewable pardon power. But the message he's sending is loud and clear, and that is that his position, certainly as commander-in-chief, is that U.S. forces, whether they be official or private forces, should not be accountable for war crimes. And he has made this position known time and again, probably most notably in sanctioning the International Criminal Court, because it wants to investigate the U.S. for war crimes in Afghanistan. So this pardon underscores the position, I think, not just of Donald Trump, but of the U.S. government in general, that the U.S. is above international law. And when it comes to war, the U.S. Can do anything it pleases.
Now, let me turn to Istanbul, to Hatem Yavuz. Trump granted the clemency at a time of a strong anti-U.S. sentiment in Iraq, where people and also parliamentarians want U.S. Boots out of their country. So what's behind this total regard of the Iraqi people's hard feeling?
I actually don't want to go there. I want to go to where the U.S. is heading itself. I mean, the elections, the health system, the judicial system now in the U.S., this year, especially during the pandemic, has showed itself of all the elements of a third world country, unfortunately. Now, and going back to the Blackwater issue. Now, the Blackwater issue, the Blackwater is just a company, a mercenary group that's highly paid under the 2002 American Service Members Protection Act, which is called the Hague Invasion, meaning that any American personnel that is indicted or summoned to the Hague they don't have to extradite that person. And in the event that that person is caught and is summoned, taken to The Hague, the U.S. military can impose its military force and extract that person out of The Hague. Very hypocritical if you're talking about a country that bloats about its democracy and whatever. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, Paul Bremer, the ex-consul in Iraq, imposed the Order 17. The Order 17 that any American personnel is above the law in Iraq, playing God. Mm-hmm. So, and that's a fact. I mean, you can check up on the documents. Mm-hmm. And Paul Bremer, when he imposed that act, obviously Blackwater was basically drunk on its powers. And it overruled, rather overrided, its actions, and by, you know, killing civilians, and there are a lot more. And you've got to thank, for all this information, to hero WikiLeaks Julian Assange, who is in Belmarsh prison today, and he's the hero here because if these documents weren't exposed at that time, we wouldn't be talking about this today, would we? Mm-hmm. So. Unfortunately, Iraq is relatively not stable, relatively unstable, and it's a message to not just the Iraqis, to the whole world, that this is what happens when you have U.S. forces in your place, in your backyard. Mm-hmm. This is the rules. You know, if you want a U.S. base in your country, fine, but these are the rules. They are above the law. Now, if this continues. Now, we saw this year how the U.S. is with its elections, which is debacle. You know, a third world country doesn't have elections like this. And the health system, unfortunately, bloating about how big the health system is there. The U.S., instead of spending all that money on guns and bombs, they could have spent more money on fixing themselves up instead. But what's happening now, they are discrediting themselves. They are defaming themselves on their own. You know, empires fall. Not because of other forces, it's within themselves, because they ride against what they created. Mm-hmm. So I mean, there's another general who I have a lot of respect for, and who I've met actually twice, is General Flynn. You know, they are damaging, they defamed that poor man. I mean, honestly, he's a good man and a very intelligent man, and they defamed him in their own system. That poor guy didn't have to go to any other courts around the world. He got defamed within his own country. Mm-hmm. So the message here is, you know, you can get emotional, but technically, it's these countries that they call themselves sovereign. Are they really sovereign?
Okay, good question. Now, Daniel, the UN Human Rights Office says it's deeply concerned by the pardons, which I quote, contributes to impunity and emboldens others to commit such crimes in the future. Do you share the same view?
Absolutely. I mean, of course. This was a clear violation of international humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions, frankly, of just basic, you know, human decency. And to pardon these people, again, at the last minute as Trump is leaving office, just sends a terrible message to the world. It tells the world the U.S. really doesn't care about human rights. Most of us who've been paying attention know that, but this really underscores that position. It should also be noted there's a bit of, you know, nepotism here, too. You know, Prince, who is the head of Blackwater, it's now been renamed, is the brother of Betsy DeVos, who is the head of education, you know, under. So, you know, there's both, big messages being sent and then kind of small-time corruption messages being sent, none of which are very good. And I agree with my colleague who said that the U.S., well, he said is becoming a third world country. I live here. It already is a third world country. I saw one meme I like quite a bit. The U.S. is a third world country without health care. And that's true. You know, we are one of the most economically disparate countries on earth. It is being eaten from within. It's not being threatened from outside. It never really was threatened from the outside. But it is corrupt at its core.
Now back to Istanbul. Hatem, you talk about a general. I have another one here for you, retired American General Mark Hertling, who used to serve in Iraq, and he has called this pardon egregious and disgusting. And now we have some others that regard this as self-serving pardons that reward friends and gratify political constituency. What's your assessment of this move?
I agree with him because, you know, I know many military personnel, and in my past especially, and they are very, very smart and noble people and very correct in their actions. But, you know, I think the U.S. is poisoned by its power. And that's what's dismantling its whole structure. For example, if Trump pardoned Manning or Assange or Edward Snowden, for example, this could have sent another message to the whole world that we are still decent. You know, these issues. I mean, I'm reading the news with Assange. The man's dying in prison. Hasn't been summoned into the context because recently there was a leak that Assange told the U.S. State Department about the documents that were going to be released, but they did nothing about it. Mainstream media in the U.S. are blinded. They don't do anything at all. So the people, they brainwash their own people. I mean, look at the U.S. TV stations. You will not hear these sort of debates on TV at all. So, you know, it's all about ethics. Forget the law. You know, if you really want to be a superpower, and that's what they want to be, you have to base yourself on ethics, not all this, you know, showing some guns and printing money just to shut the planet up. It's not happening anymore.
Now, Daniel, one basic question. Why should Washington recruit notorious private security firms like Blackwater to carry out operations in different parts of the world? Is it meant to evade accountability?
Well, I think it is. I think that's what it is to do. Because, first of all, it evades accountability, first and foremost, to the American people, because there's a lot less accountability for those private firms than there are for the official military. You know, we rarely know how many even personnel these private companies have in theater, whereas we, you know, generally it's easier to know and easier for Congress to know how many official military personnel are in theater at any time. So one, it really evades accountability to the American people, to the American Congress, and yes, it evades accountability to the international law system, to you know, the system which requires the U.S. to abide by the Geneva Conventions. So it is an underground, essentially, means of conducting war without having to answer for the conduct of the war.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct. And at the same time, private contractors can hire people from all around the world. Like Blackwater has people from, one is from Bulgaria that was summoned as well. Mm-hmm. So they can hire people from all over the world, all types of experiences. So the accountability is not there. And in the ICC states, which I know very well, the ICC, you cannot summon a private person or a company. It's between sovereign countries and the internal warring parties that are officially declared. And Blackwater is not a warring party. It's just a contract. It's a company. And basically, they just do what they have to do. So, you know, you've got the Russian Wagner Group, you've got the French Legionnaires, and it just goes on. So it's been like this not just for recently, it's been like this for a few decades.
Right. Hadam, I just wanted to ask you about Daniel also referred to, you know, the fact that the now defunct Blackwater's owner was Eric Prince, and he's
Eric
a close
Prince,
supporter
yeah.
of President Trump and brother of his Secretary of Education. What does this tell you?
Well, you know, Trump is a very staunch supporter of its military and personnel in the military, and he's right to be. Eric Prince. Well, you know, he's made a lot of money out of this business. And, you know, these connections wasn't from Trump. It all started from the Bush era. You know, it didn't start from Trump. You know, Eric Prince was being, what's the word, honored for many years. So, you know, having a person in the, his brother in the health department. It's nothing new. I mean, you know, people do favors for each other, and it's all about favors. It's corrupt. Yeah, it happens all around the world. It's corrupt, but these favors are there on the table for when Trump was voted for president in 2016. Eric Prince did a lot of favors for Trump as well.
And Hatem, what do you expect to happen? Hatem, what do you expect to happen when the new president takes the helm of the affairs of the White House? Will Washington continue taking advantage of the services of private security firms like Blackwater?
Well, they were still there during the Obama administration, so it's not going to change much. You know, we've got to realize something. The president is just a tool. The deep state, I will call it, the Pentagons and whatever you want to call it, and the CIAs, they actually structure what's going to happen. So whatever the president is dictated basically to do, he will do it. So I don't think much is going to change. I think that the new president Biden, who is also very an experienced person, and you know, as foreign affairs, especially in the past, will try his best, but he's got a lot of problems within the country itself to fix before he starts going off to other countries and telling them what to do, basically.
Mm-hmm. So, Hatem, what do you expect?
I don't see much going to change. Okay. Nothing's going to change.
Now, talking about Iraq, you know, Trump is doing this at a time when there is this deep anti-U.S. sentiment running in Iraq. Also, parliamentarians want foreign forces out, especially U.S. forces. So what is this an indication of when Trump is doing this and giving those people who are blamed for the massacre of a number of Iraqi people, including children, clemency?
Well, you know, what's going to happen, I'll call it the chemical reaction. I won't call it the emotional chemical reaction, you want to call it. The Iraqi administration will, you know, try to side more with Turkey and more with Iran, and, you know, make allegiance with them as much as they can because of this betrayal, I will call it. It's a purely betrayal by the U.S. government. So these, you know, going out on the streets and protesting and trying to, you know, throw bombs in the green zone, et cetera, in Baghdad, it's not going to help. What's going to help is if the country becomes more united, in not just in the government but also in the public, it becomes more united to show that, you know, this force called the United States Army is no longer wanted. But this power vacuum, there's a problem with a power vacuum that will take over, and that could be, you know, with the influence of Iran, because, you know, don't forget Iraq is 60% Shiite or something like that,
right.
So, you know, these sort of mm-hmm. issues are on the balance, and I'm seeing Turkey working very strongly with Iraq recently, making some breakthrough grounds in terms of security and allegiances. However, you know, we've got an ally, so-called ally, called the United States in Iraq. So, what do they do? Can they kick them out? Maybe, I don't know. But it's a message to the world. You know, it's not a message just to Iraq.
Right.
You've got Afghanistan. You've got many other places.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments. We had the author of No More War, Daniel Kovalik in Pittsburgh, who just left us a few minutes ago, and also diplomat and public analyst Hatem Yavuz, who joined us from Istanbul. And thank you. I've been your host, Behruz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره. Last night we talked about a very important dimension of balance that must exist in every person and in our community. And that is the balance that we should strike between being emotional and being rational. We need to have both, and if we lose one of them or if we overdo one of them, then it creates problems. I mentioned two hadith about the significance of having a kind of emotional unity or connection or link with Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And now I'm going to share with you the third hadith, which leads us to another characteristic of the community, and that is truthfulness. Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam, in a famous hadith, said, إن الله تبارك وتعالى أطلع إلى الأرض فاختارنا واختار لنا شيعة. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala looked at the earth, looked at the people, and among them he chose us. And he chose for us some Shia, some followers. ينصروننا. These are the people that help us. These are the people that work for achieving our goals. Then Imam Ali alayhi salam said, sometimes there are some Shia who might have some sinful actions. A Shia is not supposed to commit any sin. But if that happens, then to be able to be, you know, to be able to join us, they have to be purified. مَا مِنَ الشِّيعَةِ عَبْدٌ يُقَارِفُ أَمْرًا نَهَيْنَاهُ عَنْهُ. There is no Shia who does something, who commits something that we have prohibited. For example, if you read the hadith of Ahlul Bayt, you find they said you must not tell lies, you must not cheat, you must not backbite, you must not do zulm. Many things the Ahlul Bayt have said we should not do. If a Shia does one of those things, then Imam alayhi salam says, before he dies, yubtala bibaliyatin. He would go through some difficulties. Some calamities, some tragedies happen to him. Tumah hasobeha dhunubuhu. By those difficulties and troubles and sufferings, his sins will be removed. It's like the dirt that sometimes you need to remove by force. Sometimes you have to, you know, put lots of pressure or, you know, use something to remove the dirt. Emma fi malihi. Sometimes the problem happens in his properties, monies, investment, so on and so forth. Wa emma fi wuldihi. Sometimes he suffers in his children. They become ill, they become poor, they would have difficulties. And you know, as a father or as a mother, you suffer more when your children suffer than when you yourself suffer. So it's very difficult for you. وَأَمَّا فِي نَفْسِهِ. Oh, he himself would have some problem. He becomes ill. He becomes poor. He would have, I don't know, marriage problem, or I don't know, problem in work, problem with neighbors. Of course, in barakats, I have to say, you should not judge about the people who have these problems that because they have done some sins, they are suffering. Because there are many different reasons why someone is suffering. One reason can be that it is because this is a good person and Allah wants to forgive him. Those who are very, very bad, they will never suffer so that they can be forgiven. And also there are people who suffer not because they have committed sin, because Allah wants to raise their position. So never judge, you know, when you see someone is ill or his, you know, child is ill, you know, this must have done, you know, something wrong and Allah is, you know, punishing him. No. This is for a very special group of people who are good in essence, but they have done something bad and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants to purify them and clean them, so that nothing remains for the day of judgment.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
So, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tests this person in his money, his children, himself, حَتَّى يَلْقَى اللَّهَ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ وَمَا لَهُ مِنْ ذَنْبٍ. So that when he meets Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, no sin is there. For sure, it is better for all of us if our sins are forgiven in this way rather than being forgiven or purified or cleaned in hell. Mu'mineen, sometimes they may go to hell and then they come out. Because you know, mu'min never remains forever in hell. But even remaining in hell for a day is something that we cannot tolerate. So if there is anything to suffer for, it's better if it happens in dunya rather than akhirah. Then Amirul Mu'minin said, also it is possible that وَإِنَّهُ لَيَبْقَى عَلَى الشَّيْءٍ مِّن ذُنُوبِهِ. Sometimes also something can remain. Maybe he had too much sins, or maybe that was a type of sin which was not possible to be cleaned in the way that we explained. So, فَيُشَدَّدُ بِهِ عَلَيْهِ عِنْدَ مَوْتِهِ. Then Allah will make it difficult for him the time of departure from dunya. He would have some problem at the time of death. The pain, the pressure, the difficulties of death is something that we cannot understand. You shouldn't think that, you know, when you are sitting next to one, you know, who is dying and he doesn't say anything, it means that this is not painful for him. We don't understand. Maybe a person dies very nicely in our eyes, but he is suffering. Maybe a person is being burnt by enemies and he's not suffering. We have hadith about the martyrs of Karbala that they didn't feel the pain of the swords. Everyone must think that, oh, they are suffering a lot. But they were so much attracted to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that they were not feeling any pain. So, you cannot judge by looking at the body of someone whether that person is suffering or not. You know, now, for example, here we have, you know, tens or hundreds of people. When we look at people, say, oh, this man is not suffering. He's very happy. But you don't know, maybe in his heart, he is very sad. Or someone is sleeping. We don't feel anything, but maybe he has very bad dream and is suffering. So, we cannot judge who is dying peacefully and who is dying with difficulties. For sure, some people die with difficulties. And Amir al-Mu'mineen says that for some Shia, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made this kind of arrangement that their sins can be forgiven at that time. So, we must not think that because we are Shia, then automatically everything is forgiven, or, you know, no one will keep a record of what we do because we are Shia, we are lovers of Ahlul Bayt. No. We have to be extra careful and they expect from us more.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. Oh Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. Oh Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. Oh Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way,
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the World with Reporters. Karina was a working mom with a job in the tourism sector, decimated by the pandemic. With no savings to fall back on, and with her husband's delivery job earnings nowhere near enough for them to get by, they ended up in a position no one wants to find themselves.
I never knew about Food Bank. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Karina's quest for help led her to Educare Family Support Service, one of many publicly funded companies helping families down on their luck in the age of COVID.
We have lots of different food items that will go in. The plan behind it was that we would be able to prepare hampers for families who, disadvantaged families who may not be able to afford to have a Christmas meal or Boxing Day meal. So we've ensured that we've provided a hamper with everything excluding the meat. At the moment we're on about 270. Literally that is 270 families.
270 of many more families facing food insecurity and hunger, exacerbated by the pandemic, a situation that's drawn in UNICEF for the first time in its 70-year history in this country.
In these unprecedented times, I would imagine that these families have become known to their professionals that they're engaging with and are now require additional support.
This cavernous space is the interior of an Anglican church in West London. In normal times, it would see worshippers kneeling in prayer. Today, it's dedicated to something more pressing, getting food into people's cupboards.
I got quite emotional, actually, about, you know, just the thought that you're privileged and get to enjoy Christmas and then other people are going without, especially at the moment with these troubled times. So I thought if I can come and make just a little bit of difference.
These hampers are being stuffed with supplies to last families for a few days. People used to go to food banks to pick them up. Since the onset of COVID, the whole project of compassion has taken on a new dimension, deliveries.
These volunteer drivers will be dropping off food and presents at hundreds of households for the next 3 days. A drop in the bucket considering the number of families depending on these supplies. And some of those families have up to 6 children.
Most of these volunteers found out about this project on social media. Some of them have dedicated their only day off to being here.
To see the family smiles and the people who need the things is, you know, I can't explain what you feel. The smile of them faces just can give me the energy. They can make my day.
Some have brought their young ones along so they can see firsthand what their less fortunate peers are going through. Those with bigger vehicles have come as couples to help transport more of this humanitarian assistance to homes where kitchen cabinets are not restocked as often as they should.
It's nothing for me to offer a couple of hours, so we are also in a position where it could be me who needs this support.
This year has been very contrasting in the fact that there's some people just getting richer and richer and richer, and we're reaching rock bottom, really, in sense of community is getting destroyed, really.
If you're feeding a family of 4 to 6 people, that's going to last, 2 days. It will get them through till Christmas Eve, hopefully.
And we all think we're struggling. Karina has had to adapt to her new world, caring for her 3-year-old daughter in a small rented apartment with no garden while her husband works, and looking after her ailing father who lives on his own.
I know a lot of people are suffering during this difficult time. It's very challenging, but you have to be positive at all times. Seek for help. If you don't ask, you don't get it.
Would you like some?
Karina is perhaps one of the tens of thousands of families, if not more, for whom survival depends on charitable donations. Saeed Pariza, London.
Christmas Eve 2020, Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed off on an historic post-Brexit trade and security agreement with the European Union after an intense 24-hour negotiation period. A press conference expected early in the day finally came in the afternoon after lawyers and translators had crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
I'm very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have completed the biggest trade deal yet, worth £660 billion. A year, a comprehensive Canada-style free trade deal between the UK and the EU, a deal that will protect jobs across this country, a deal that will allow goods, UK goods and components to be sold without tariffs and without quotas in the EU market, a deal which will, if anything, allow our companies and our exporters to do even more business with our European friends.
A deal will mean Britain finally leaving the bloc's single market and customs union in a week, and freedom of movement will end. It also settles the future arrangements on a vast range of issues, from aviation and transport to civil nuclear cooperation and energy. The sticking points that took Brexit to the brink of no deal was access to British fishing waters, a contentious issue that prompted the UK to send Navy ships to the English Channel in case of clashes, and the level playing field, which is an important part of the EU single market, allowing for fair and open competition.
Les négociations ont été très difficiles.
The negotiations were very difficult, with lots at stake for many, and it was an agreement worth fighting for. Will allow us to avoid major disruptions to workers, businesses and travellers after January 1st. It will protect European interests, and this agreement is also, I believe, in the interests of the United Kingdom. It will lay solid foundations for a new start with long-time friends, and finally, it will ensure we can leave Brexit behind us. Europe continues to move forward. Despite the collective sighs of relief and resignation across Britain, the devil is in the detail. French media made waves in the hours leading up to it by asserting the UK had made huge concessions, something Westminster was quick to deny. Hardline Tory Brexiteers from the European Research Group have said its star chamber of lawyers will be convened to analyse the proposed agreement, suggesting it's not over yet. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Pakistan had a fresh round of negotiations with the UAE in an effort to repair lingering strained relations between the two countries. Pakistan has been under pressure from the UAE to normalize ties with the apartheid state of Israel since August this year, when Abu Dhabi recognized Tel Aviv. For the first time, Islamabad publicly admitted about the existence of a lingering UAE demand to Pakistan to grant diplomatic recognition to Israel. Something which Islamabad rejected after the country's foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi.
I have abundantly made it clear to the UAE that Pakistan under no circumstances can establish diplomatic ties with Israel until a permanent and durable solution is found to the Palestinian issue. I have told them about anti-Israeli public sentiments in Pakistan and reminded them of the similar nature of dispute between Kashmir and Palestine.
Foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi has followed suspension of visas to Pakistani citizens after alleged behind-the-scenes threats to Islamabad to replace its 1.5 million expatriates if Pakistan resisted pressure to normalize ties with Tel Aviv.
Pakistan made its position clear because of the mounting pressure from some of the Islamic countries. The problem for Pakistan is that at the public level, at the people level, it is very difficult to sell this idea of giving recognition to Israel, because for decades, Pakistani people have been steadfastly supporting the cause of the Palestinian people.
Despite close brother relations with the UAE, tens of thousands of people protested against the Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with the Tel Aviv. Israel has been desperate to normalize ties with Pakistan, hoping that if it happens, other Islamic countries would also follow the suit. However, observers say that Israel's effort through UAE and Saudi Arabia to create compelling conditions against Pakistan to normalize ties have fallen flat. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The United Nations Security Council has held a virtual meeting to review the 10th report into the implementation of Resolution 2231, which endorses the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. During the session on Tuesday, Iran's permanent representative to the UN slammed the United States for not only failing to honor its own obligations under the resolution, but also obstructing the implementation of the commitments by other signatories. Takrabanchi explained that in the past 4 years, the U.S. has imposed over 1,500 sanctions against Iran, targeting almost all sectors of Tehran's economy and cutting nearly all dividends from the nuclear agreement for Iran. He also referred to the humanitarian impacts of the sanctions on Iran, saying the embargoes are affecting the most vulnerable people in the country.
The United States claim that humanitarian goods are exempt from sanctions is an absolute lie. As an example, even today, we cannot easily import medicine for relieving the breathing problems of those injured by chemical weapons which were provided by some Western countries to Saddam and used by him during his aggression against Iran.
The Iranian ambassador reiterated Tehran's stance that any proposal for the revision, renegotiation, or extension of the JCPOA is against the UN Resolution 2231 and absolutely unacceptable.
Iran has paid a heavy price and has done much more than its fair share to preserve the JCPOA. Therefore, no one can expect us to do more.
Takrabanchi further said that the deal cannot be linked to anything outside of the nuclear program, such as Iran's missile capabilities.
To develop a conventional missile program is an inherent right of any country under international law, and Iran is no exception. Consequently, Iran will not negotiate its legitimate ballistic missile program.
The Security Council session came a day after the foreign ministers of the remaining signatories to the JCPOA held a virtual meeting and reiterated their commitments to preserving the agreement. China and Russia in particular call on the U.S. to unconditionally return to the deal and lift its unilateral sanctions against Iran. This comes more than 3 weeks after the Iranian parliament passed a bill that requires the Iranian government to suspend more commitments under the nuclear deal in case sanctions continue. Iran started scaling back some of its commitments a year after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal. Tehran has time and again rejected any preconditions for reviving the agreement, noting that it will go back to full compliance once all the other parties to the court uphold their own end of the deal.
Yemeni scholars came together in the capital Sana'a to condemn some Arab states for normalizing ties with the Israeli regime. They said with signing normalization deals with Israel, these states have betrayed the Palestinians.
We've announced the continuous processes of normalization of ties with the Zionist entity. We are here to warn other Arab states not to follow the same path. Any normalization deal amounts to the betrayal of the blood of the martyrs who sacrificed their lives to protect the occupied lands against Israeli aggression.
Morocco has been the last Arab state to normalize ties with Israel after Bahrain, the UAE, and Sudan over the past months.
The scholars of Yemen reiterate their opposition to any recognition of the Zionist enemy. We believe that it amounts to betrayal of the Muslim values. This will pave the way for further aggression against the Palestinians.
The normalization deals have already sparked outrage among the public in the Muslim world, with a pro-Palestine sentiment runs deep. Meanwhile, Palestinians from all political factions have been unanimous in their condemnation of the normalization deals. They seek an independent state in the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip with the East Jerusalem Al-Quds as its capital. So the normalization, they say, serves as betrayal of their cause.
Yemeni scholars voiced their support for the Palestinians, warning Arab world to adopt a united stance against Israeli aggression. They say the normalization deals will only embolden Israel to press ahead with its oppressive policies against the Palestinians. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنعاء.
In each of the 27 EU nations, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine will start being used in less than a week's time on the 27th of December. The European Medicines Agency has given its approval and has played down concerns that the new highly contagious COVID-19 variant spreading in England will not respond to the vaccine.
These are issues that need to be fully scientifically assessed. At the moment, we can say that there is no evidence to suggest that the vaccine will not work against the new variant of the coronavirus.
The UK is now isolated as countries around the world impose travel restrictions due to the new, more infectious strain of the coronavirus. There has been travel chaos for millions. People have been trying to get out of the UK before travel bans are enforced. There is major disruption at the main trading corridors between the UK and EU. Global markets have been in disarray due to the deepening health crisis in Europe. Rather than waiting for other countries to make the first move, epidemiologists are saying the British government should have done the responsible thing and blocked all non-essential travel from the UK. We have been getting reactions from members of the public in Brussels.
It's maybe a little bit too late to close borders, and I don't think closing borders doesn't help either.
We really have to stick to the situation, to respect it, and then we will, as soon as possible, be able to open everything again.
It's a new thing, we don't know what it is, but we need to act, I think, faster, and maybe in the beginning a little bit harder.
If government imposed like that strict lockdown like they did in South Korea or like North Korea and China, I think there will be riots here.
The European Medicines Agency says it is currently in contact with 46 vaccine developers, and it expects to approve the Moderna jab on the 6th of January. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
All flights and trains coming from the United Kingdom have been barred from entering Europe. Other countries, including Canada, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Colombia, and Morocco, have also suspended flights to and from the UK for 48 hours or more. Britons have been rattled by the Prime Minister's announcement that Christmas visits will have to be cancelled because of the new COVID-19 strain. And now there are growing fears the country will run out of fresh food in the days before Christmas because of freight and transport disruption. The government insists there's nothing to be worried about, though, and that ahead of Brexit, the government is fully prepared.
It's vital first to stress that these delays, which are only occurring at Dover, only affect human-handled freight, and that is only 20% of the total arriving from or departing to the European continent, which means the vast majority of food, medicines and other supplies are coming and going as normal.
The British government is dealing with an escalating public health crisis, deepening economic upheaval and Brexit trade talks in Brussels simultaneously. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's handling of all three crises has come under fire and faith in the government is waning.
It's just got to a point where now people are just going to feel like their freedom is being restricted and their basic sort of human rights, and it's spending millions of pounds on an app that doesn't even work. So, I mean, yeah, making promises they can't adhere to. So I think, yeah, they've really shot themselves in the foot.
They're doing an okay job. I think obviously they could probably do better. But, you know, I think it's always easy when you're looking on the outside in, going, you know, we'd do this or that.
No more promises that we'll be over this by such and such a date, a day at a time now. I mean, it's a difficult situation for the government. But no more promises. We'll be over this by Christmas, Easter, a day at a time. It's debatable. Who would want to be in the government situation at the moment? It's changing by the day worldwide.
I think, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. I would urge people to think about, you know, what would they have done if they'd have been faced with everything that has happened, because I don't necessarily think that there's one right course of action. I don't necessarily think that our government have handled it the perfect way, but what is the perfect way kind of thing? And I don't think people have helped themselves by rebelling against the rules and all of that kind of thing. So
people are going to complain no matter what Boris Johnson says or does. So
the new strain of COVID-19 has already been detected in the Netherlands, Denmark, Belgium and Iceland. On the upside, the scientists are saying the new strain is not resistant to the vaccines now being approved and administered. More than 500,000 people have received the Pfizer jab in the UK, which was the first country to approve it, and Europe's medicine regulators have approved it as well, which means inoculations will be underway across the bloc in a matter of days. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Can you download an HD movie in 1 second? Thanks to 5G internet, yes. While around 50 countries have already launched the fifth generation broadband service, Iran is also jumping on the wagon to roll out the high-speed internet network. Iran's Science and Technology Vice Presidency says 5G coverage will for now be available in the country's Kish Island and will soon reach other regions.
We can now say that Iran is one of the first countries that stepped into this modern technology. We have built the needed infrastructure in Kish Island and at the same time are working on major locations such as Tehran to roll out the technology.
Iran successfully tested 5G in July when users reported a 1.5 gigabit per second of download speed on their mobile phones. However, Iran's ST Vice Presidency says 5G for now will not be offered for household applications and will initially be limited to industrial uses, such as smart transportation.
With 5G's low latency, reliability, and powerful connections, we can create an integrated transport network that connects all cars together and also connects personal cars to police for instant guidance and warnings.
Not also in our country, but also most of the countries, 5G infrastructures aren't implemented yet. So we need pass time for implementing these infrastructures. And after that, we can use the use cases of 5G.
The deployment of 5G technology is expected to boost Iran's infrastructure for accommodating sensitive online services through domestic servers. Experts say this would significantly increase the cloud computing capacity in the country.
Some 70 million Iranian SIM card owners currently use the third and fourth generation of mobile internet. They still have to wait to see the 5G icon appearing on the top corner of their smartphones. But Iran's ICT officials promised to make 5G internet available for widespread personal use by the end of 2022. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Austrian government announces a third hard lockdown starting immediately after Christmas on the 26th of December. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz had promised that the second lockdown, which ended 2 weeks ago, would save Christmas. But that mission has proven to be nearly impossible. Like the majority of nations around the world, Austrians are not expecting a regular Christmas or New Year's Eve. But things don't look entirely bleak, as vaccinations are set to begin across Europe and Austria on the 27th of December. With every week, says Chancellor Kurz, we get a step closer to ending this pandemic.
Measures will become stricter until the seven-day incident is below 100, and in mid-January, there will be free mass tests for everyone who wants to take part.
The goal is to keep weekly cases below 100 per 100,000 people. That number currently stands at just under 200. The lockdown is expected to end on January 18th, but only for those who agree to get tested. For those not willing to take the test, the stay-at-home order and curfew will be in place for another extra week. Health Minister Rudolf Anschober expressed concern over the dramatic increase in mortalities across the country over the last 2 months.
With no further measures, at the end of the month, new cases could range between 1,300 and 3,000 cases a day.
For now, the new restrictions mean everyone entering Austria from abroad has to go into a 10-day quarantine, which can only be cut short after 5 days with a negative